It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe, and with me now is a man who walks for different reasons. Robert Buckley lives in Marion. He's retired from the advertising business, and in his retirement, he has completed 5 incredible long-distance hikes, the last one at the age of 70. He's written about his adventures in the book 2 Miles an Hour, and he is here in the studio with me now. Hello, Robert.
Hello.
Thank you so much for being here today.
Well, I'm happy to be here.
Now, the first hike that you took was actually a little bit before retirement.
Right.
And you hiked some of the Appalachian Trail. Where did that idea come from?
I try to remember that because people ask me that all the time, and I'm not clear. I think, you know, everybody's heard of the Appalachian Trail, at least I had. And I think the thing that probably got me going on it was a television show I'd seen about a fellow who had walked the entire trail, which is, you know, over 2,000 miles, and he was blind. And he had a dog as a guide. And I thought, you know what? That sounds like it'd be fun. If he can do it, I should, you know, I should be able to do part of it.
Right.
So I did.
Well, and you had been doing RAGBRAI for a number of years,
right,
which, of course, is not walking across the state of Iowa, but you've been bicycling across the state of Iowa. So was there a correlation in your mind between doing that kind of long-distance bike ride and doing a long-distance hike?
Yeah, I think there is. You know, they're both require good legs. And I biked RAGBRAI, I think, for 10 years. And it was fun. You know, anybody who's ever done it or heard about it knows that it's fun. But after 10 years, you know, I thought, well, maybe I'll try something different. I did RAGBRAI mainly with people at work. And, you know, about the 10th year, people started to drop out anyway. So, and I was getting ready to retire. And I thought, I'm still in good health. My legs are decent. I'm going to try something different. And so I kind of did some reading and thought, well, you know, I can do part of the Appalachian Trail. I was still working, so I only had a couple of weeks. So I figured, how far could I go? So I kind of mapped out something and took off.
All right. So RAGBRAI, as we all know, is an incredible social event.
Yes.
There are
well, it depends on your
people.
Age, but yes, it can
right,
be.
But I mean, even if you're not a partier,
right,
still, you're always talking to people along the route. There are so many people to meet, and everybody's smiling and open faces and yep, ready to make friends. Now,
right,
hiking the Appalachian Trail by yourself is a much more solitary experience. Were you looking for something more solitary?
I thought I'd run into more people, quite honestly. No, I wasn't really. I figured, you know, I'd run into these guys and we'd meet and we'd walk, become great friends. But it really didn't happen that way. I think possibly it was the time of the year. You know, it was in September. People were back at work and school. And as a result, there were several days that I walked, I didn't see a soul, you know, which was a little disconcerting, I have to admit.
Right. And in September, the days are getting shorter. That
mm-hmm.
means the nights are getting longer. So it was dark for a lot of your
right.
experience as well.
That's right, particularly up in the mountain areas. Usually a rule of thumb for me was be there by 4 at the latest, because by 5 the sun started to go behind you. And by 6:37 it was pitch black. So, you know, it was.
So you're all by yourself. You're camping. And you're in a tent, and it's black for 12 hours.
At least.
So the other thing about this, though, you had not ever, ever gone backpacking
no,
before.
No, it's true. I hadn't.
So what did you do to prepare yourself to go backpacking?
Well, I didn't buy anything new other than a pair of boots. And I dug out an old backpack that, you know, the kids had in the basement. And I had a huge tent,
a five-person
cabin tent. And I thought, my God, what was I thinking? The tent alone weighed about 12 pounds. And so I figured, well, that's no big deal. You know, I could do that. And when the whole thing came together at the airplane, when they weighed everything in, it was 45 pounds, which was, you know, over twice what it should have been.
Right. So
I didn't know that at the
45
time.
45 pounds, and not just an incredibly heavy backpack, but this was not one of these newfangled light aluminum frame backpacks with the proper folding, foam on your shoulders. And
it was a 1960 vintage Boy Scout pack. You know, it didn't even have a waistband on it. But, you know, I figured it'd be all right. And it was for the first, 15, 20 minutes.
Right. Well, you even when you tried it out here in Iowa, you did try to walk around the block.
Yeah, I didn't do very well.
Right. So that wasn't a red flag for you?
Well, it was for my wife. But I'm the eternal optimist, and I figured, I probably went out a week or two prior to my walk, before I left. And I thought, I could do this, but I never really got it right. I couldn't really stand up straight, and I couldn't walk very straight. But I figured, I'll get better as time goes by. But I didn't have any time.
Right. And you kept saying that, it's mostly food, and I'll just eat that up.
Yeah, I bought canned food. Can you believe that? I had cans of spaghetti in there, And I've mentioned this to people before. I've asked people if they've ever read Bill Bryson's A Walk in the Woods, and most people had. It's a great book. And my adventure was pretty much like that. It was before that happened, but it was pretty much like that, just tons of dumb mistakes.
So you made a lot of mistakes. You also discovered that you really didn't like camping alone.
No, I didn't.
How long did it take for you to figure that out?
Oh, gosh, two or three nights, I suppose. I think it was before I get up to Massachusetts, I ran into a couple of guys, and I really only camped with people once. And that was one night, and they were going opposite directions. One was a thru hiker, very focused, and the other one was some lawyer, street lawyer from New York, that was just up in the woods for a few days. He didn't even have a tent, and I was amazed at that. I mean, I thought I was doing dumb things, but he managed quite well. But that was the only time I really ran into anybody at a campsite, which I thought was bizarre. It was actually only, I think, 8 or 9 or 10 days that I actually walked.
So after that experience, and you, as you mentioned, you made a lot of rookie mistakes. One of them, you did buy really nice hiking boots, but you didn't really break them in.
Not very well.
Right. So you had some foot pain. You were lonely.
Yeah.
You were incredibly sore, right, because you're carrying this backpack that's bruising you as you're carrying it, and it's way too heavy.
That's right. And in New York, you couldn't have a fire. And I was used to camping like at Walnut Woods State Park with a nice roaring fire and people around toasting. You couldn't do that because of the right-of-way and New York, Connecticut. And so I was not only by myself, I didn't have a fire to kind of fall back on. So it was kind of bleak, but it was okay.
So after hearing all of this, you come home. And a couple of years later, you decide, I want to go do something like that again. What was it about that experience that was actually positive that you took away?
Well, it was a learning experience. I mean, that's for sure. And it was a challenge. And I think I survived all right. But I think what it did is it really whetted my appetite for doing it better. And of course, I was on the East Coast, and if things had gone wrong, I could have gotten on a bus or a train and gotten home. This time, I wanted to do it a little differently, and so I decided to do the English coast-to-coast walk. And there again, based on a magazine article I had read somewhere, I think it was National Travel or something.
All right, so the English coast-to-coast walk, and this is, you had retired at this point?
I had.
All right.
I was retired maybe 2 years.
All right, so you had a little more time.
I had more time. I was a little smarter. As you said, I invested in a little bit better equipment. I got rid of the huge tent, and I bought a really nice backpack, about a 3,000 square inch backpack, just enough for about 20 pounds worth of stuff. And I'd never planned to camp on this walk anyway, so I didn't need to worry about a tent or a ground cloth or any of that kind of stuff.
Now, for people who have not heard of it, what is the coast-to-coast hike in England?
there's a walk that goes across northern England from one side of the North Sea to the Irish Sea. And it's called the Wainwright's Coast to Coast. He was a naturalist that lived over in England a few years back. And he came up with this path that connected the towns of St. Bees on the North Sea to the Irish Sea to over to Robin Hood Bay. And he designed it so that it went through three national parks, the Lake District and the North York Moors and I can't even tell you the third parks area. But the North York Moors were the most interesting. And there's an actual path. So it wasn't something I made up myself. It was an actually prescribed path.
All right. And in this case, you're on a path that other people are familiar with. And it was known, but not exactly a wildly popular path. But right. You did run into other people who they knew about it, and they were also hiking the same path.
That's right. And that's the thing that made this walk so much different than the other ones. And Yorkshire Dales, I just had a senior moment there. I met some people the day I started, and I ended up walking with them an awful long part of the way. They were all English and a couple of Scots. And that made the biggest difference, I think, having somebody to kind of run into from time to time. I was still by myself. I wasn't part of a group, so I didn't have to worry about keeping up with anyone. But at night, since it was a prescribed route, we all ended up in the same village. And we'd run into each other and usually go out to eat together. And so that made a big difference, I think.
I'm talking with Robert Buckley. He has gone on five incredible long walks or hikes in the past few years, and he's written about his adventures in the book 2 Miles an Hour. If you'd like to join our conversation, you're welcome to. If you had an adventure like this, tell us about your adventure. Give us a call, 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. So how many miles was this coast-to-coast journey?
The English coast-to-coast walk is 190 miles, if you do it correctly.
All right. And how long did you allot yourself?
I only had 12 days. I still wanted to keep it roughly to a two-week period, so my wife didn't get too upset that I was gone too long. But normally it would be a 14- or 16-day walk. I hurried it up a little bit, which was another mistake, but I did. I managed.
So about how many miles a day were you averaging?
I think the smallest or the shortest day was like 9 miles. And the longest day, if I remember correctly, was like 23 miles. I'm not sure what that would average out to. Divided out 190 by 12, maybe 14 average miles a day, 14, 15.
And what was the terrain like?
Well, the terrain was great. I started the walk on the west coast of England, and so I attacked what they call the hill country or the Lake District first, and it was very, very hilly. Yeah, beautiful hills, but the Lake District has got thousands of miles of walking trails, but it was hilly, and it was difficult. The dales were a little different. They weren't quite as steep, and they were more kind of all things great and small type of James Herriot type country. But the moors were altogether different again. So the terrain is three distinctly different areas of England, which is, I guess, the reason the walk's so popular.
And England is not famous for having beautiful weather. What was your weather like?
You know, I took five walks, and I have to say that only on two of them that I really absolutely get drenched. And this wasn't one of them. I was so lucky. People couldn't believe it. I got rained on, but, you know, not like you'd expect. And you're right. In September in Europe, traditionally, it can be cold and nasty. I guess I was just lucky.
Now, on that walk, the coast-to-coast walk, your worst injury actually occurred when you were staying in a B&B and you were bathing. What happened?
Right. My knee was giving me a little trouble, and so I was in an older bed and breakfast and a huge big bathroom, tiled floor, I remember that. But right in the middle of this huge bathroom was a clawfoot tub that was completely surrounded by a curtain. Bizarre placement, but nevertheless. So I got into this tub and I pulled the curtain closed, and my knee was hurting quite a bit for some reason. Must have been a long day. And so when I started to sit down at the tub, I was going to elevate my knee to get the water pouring on it. I slipped. And I fell back, and hidden behind the curtain in the rear of me was a faucet, handle faucet that hadn't been used because it had one of those spray shower thingies. And I hit my head on this faucet, and it just cut my head wide open. It was a mess.
So you bled all over the bathroom, you didn't get any medical care.
Now, the lady that ran the bed and breakfast said she knew a vet that I could get it stitched up. And I thought she was kidding at first, but she wasn't. And I said, no, I probably should have.
Right.
But I didn't. So I had I still have the wonderful scar in the back of my head. I finally got it to stop bleeding after a couple of hours, but it made a mess of her bathroom towels, I'll tell you that.
So you had one more day to hike after that?
I think you're right. Yeah, that was towards the end of the walk. I had one more long day before I reached Robin Hood Bay. Right.
So you've lost a lot of blood. You have this wound on your head. Your hair is caked in dried blood.
Yeah.
And it starts to rain,
yeah,
of course. And you are finishing this hike.
Yeah.
When you got done that day, what did you think? Did you think, wow, I'm so proud of myself, or I'm thankful that I survived?
I think all of that. I was proud I survived. That was a stupid thing to do. It's really the only time I've actually hurt myself on a walk. But when I got to the bed and breakfast on the other side, Mrs. Dunclave, I'll never forget her, the rain, it was melting my wound, and there was blood running down the side of my head, and she thought I just hurt myself. I said, no, this was a day or two ago.
Oh, my.
But that was part of the deal.
We're going to take a short break. I'll be back in just a moment talking with Robert Buckley. He lives in Marion, and in his retirement years, he has completed 5 long-distance hikes, the last one at the age of 70, and he's written about his adventures in the book 2 Miles an Hour. You're welcome to join our conversation at 866-780-9100. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe, and I'm talking today with Robert Buckley, who has been on some amazing adventures. He's taken 5 long-distance walks or hikes, the last one right after his 70th birthday, and he's written about his adventures in the book 2 Miles an Hour. And we'd love to hear from you, too. Have you had adventures like this? Have you gone off on a solo journey? Let us know about your adventure and what it meant to you. 866-780-9100 is the number to call, and Michael is on the line from Harper. Hi, Michael.
Hello. How are you today?
Good. What's your story?
Oh, I had several. I grew up in rural Iowa, and I walked up my creeks and everything, and first of all with my BB gun and then with my rifle. But I did a thing called MADRAC. And I don't know if your guest there has heard of it, but it's a canoe ride down the Mississippi, and it goes from place to place, different each year, but it's a week-long journey. My year was Bellevue to Burlington, and you got to go through the locks, and it was a lot of fun. I've also done 7 Ragbris, and I'm really envious of your guest about him doing the Appalachian Trail, because that's something I have longed to do, and I am 70 also, and I just don't know if my legs can handle it.
So what is it that makes you want to do something like that?
Oh, I just like being out in nature. I think that's it. I remember once up in northern Iowa on Ragbri, and the highest point in Iowa, I think 1,600 feet or something like that. And I'm looking down this valley. I'm standing there, and they said, well, you must not be from Iowa. And I says, oh, my, I am from Iowa, but I love every minute of Iowa.
Oh, that's great.
That's just it. I just love the nature of Iowa.
Well, Michael, thank you so much.
There's nothing like it.
Yeah, thanks so much for your call today. And so, Robert, your first adventure, as we said, on the Appalachian Trail, you did the hiking and the camping alone. On your subsequent journeys, you were out there in nature. You were still on your own. You were staying in actual beds at night. But what was it? Because, of course, obviously this second journey led to a third journey and a fourth journey and a fifth journey. What was it about the experience that made you want more?
I think a lot of it was just the British Isles. I just love the British Isles. And, you know, England was beautiful, and Ireland was different. Ireland was mainly a people walk. I did Wales and Scotland, and every place I think had something different to offer. And I just kind of got hooked on it, I guess. I suppose like Ragbri initially. And I just had to keep going as long as I could.
Now, for a lot of people, when we have a sort of a transcendent event like that, and then you try to do it again, to recapture that feeling, were you able to with your subsequent journeys?
Oh, sure. I did. And particularly Ireland, because I designed that walk myself. And it was across the country again. That was longer, 240-some miles by myself. But, you know, in Ireland, you're not a stranger anywhere you go. And I just, it was so much different than going to England, I thought. The food was different, the people in a way the same, but still different. And Ireland is where all my family came from anyway, so it was a special trip for me.
Your walk in Scotland is the only one that you had a companion on, a planned companion on that journey. Why do you do these alone?
You know, at my age, a lot of people don't want to take the time or the effort to do it, I think. I'd mentioned it to other friends before. Would you be interested in going for 3 weeks and walking across? Are you crazy? You know, I said, no. They didn't. But I ran into my cousin, my first cousin's husband, Jim Geeson, and he and I decided we would do Scotland together. And it was great. It worked out great. I wish I'd pushed for something like that earlier, I think.
Let's go back to the phones. Wilhelmine is on the line in Iowa City. Hello.
Hello.
Hi, what's your story?
I have hiked in the Sierra, the Adirondacks, the Blue Ridge, and have hiked both with someone and hiked alone. I've had a few encounters with black bears. I lived in New Jersey, close to the Appalachian Trail, so I did the Appalachian Trail all through the state of Pennsylvania. Hiking with someone else is very nice, but hiking alone is an entirely different experience. And it's when you experience essential freedom. And I became almost addicted to that. When I lived in New Jersey, I would keep my pack all ready to go. And every time I took the notion, I would just pick it up and go.
Oh, Wilhelmine, thank you so much for sharing that.
You're quite welcome.
The first trip that you took, Robert, on the Appalachian Trail, I mean, that was pure wilderness for so much of it. In England, in Ireland, in Scotland, in Wales, the wilderness has, for the most part, been tamed. I mean, anywhere you go, you're not too far from civilization. And that was part of the allure, I'm sure, because you were able to stay at B&Bs all the way along the way, and you didn't have to hike. Did you find that there was sort of a perfect mix of wilderness and civilization for you? Is that why you kept going back to the British Isles?
I suppose that's a good observation. I think that's true. I think the only one that probably is not quite civilization oriented or close to is Scotland. In northern Scotland, there were strips of land there was nothing anywhere near there. And I really enjoyed that walk. It was it was perhaps the most beautiful walk. But there are times out there where you're out in the middle of nowhere, and if you get in trouble, you know, you may not see anybody for 2 or 3 days. The Appalachian Trail, theoretically, every mile of that trail is covered at least once a day by a member of a participating trail club. I didn't always find that to be true, but in theory it was. So, yeah, in Scotland, at least northern Scotland, you're kind of on your own.
When you're spending all those hours walking in solitude, what do you think about?
Oh, boy. When's my next meal? Is the rain far behind? What is that over there on the side of the road? Should I go over and look to see if it's moving? And I think you get a lot of time to think. How is life going with you? Aren't I happy I can do this? What'll I do when I get home? Is everybody going to want to know, you know, about every place I've stayed? I always took cameras, and I gave a lot of talks. It does give you a lot of time to think. But most of my time, unfortunately, was spent looking at maps, trying to avoid getting lost, which I did on every walk. And, you know, that was part of the adventure, though.
Tom is on the line in Des Moines. Hi, Tom.
Yes, good morning.
Hi, what's your story?
Well, my story is of bicycling in England in 1977, and I did it solo. I did it at the end of a 2-month stay where I worked in a little furniture workshop in the North Riding of Yorkshire. And at the end, I borrowed a bicycle and went to the South Coast and back in about 2 weeks by myself, and had, if not similar adventures to your guest, I had comparable in terms of adventure, I guess. So I'm open to any questions that you might have about that.
So what do you think you learned about yourself in doing that kind of journey? Why is it a story that you still want to tell today?
Well, I've never done anything like that before or since. And it was a thing that, in context, it was after a very unsuccessful first year of graduate school. And I went back to graduate school and... it took a while to finish, but and 2 years later, I became a Christian. I think it settled me down a little bit and satisfied my appetite for experience, those kinds of experiences, say. So I think in context, it was a bit of a life-changing trip.
Tom, thank you so much for sharing.
All right.
You know, and Robert, a lot of people do journeys like this in their youth, you know, right after you graduate from college or take a summer while you're in college, that kind of thing. It's something that a lot of people do to go out and find themselves in the world, I guess. You did it at a completely different time of life. What do you think you were searching for that you went out there to look for?
Maybe I'm just a late bloomer. I don't know. I don't think I was searching for anything particular. I always like adventures. And, you know, I kind of do things in streaks, 10 miles of 10 years of Ragbrife, 10 years off and on of long-distance walking. It's just something that I feel that I really enjoy doing. I wasn't really lost. You know, my wife was there waiting for me when I came home. The kids were there. It was just something I really wanted to do.
The last hike that you write about in your book was in Wales, the Cliff Top hike. And you took that hike, 2 weeks after you turned 70?
Mm-hmm.
Was that an important milestone for you?
Well, I knew I probably didn't have a lot of walks left, or at least a lot of time left. And so I wanted to do that because it was, number one, one of the British Isles. I really wasn't that familiar with it. And number two, I thought, well, you know, this could be the last walk I take. I'm 70. I still feel great. Why not? Let's do it. I did.
On that last walk, you had the strangest experience that you had out of any of your walks.
I did.
Why don't you tell us about that?
It was early in the walk. That walk, I think, was like 80 miles. And it starts out very, very, very steep cliffs. The first four or five days, they diminish as you go. But the first couple of days, the cliffs were at least 600 feet down to the ocean. And it was just the second day, and I'm by myself, of course, and I'm walking along, and I came upon a cow that was standing in the path, you know, maybe at this point a couple hundred yards ahead of me. And I couldn't figure out how she got there because they had these fences. Eventually, it came to a break in the fence where this cow had obviously thought the grass was greener and walked out. And here she was blocking the path. I didn't know what to do. I didn't want to make her nervous. But there wasn't really room to scoot around her, even though I tried on a couple of occasions. Well, eventually I heard this screaming farmer come charging across the field to the left. And he's telling me, "Don't move, don't move." I said, I won't. So I stood quietly. And this poor guy comes up and he gets over to the cow, puts a noose around her nose or head, whatever, and tries to back her away from the edge of the cliff, which at that point was like 3 feet, 2 to 3 feet behind her. She didn't know it. She was pointing the opposite direction. And I don't know what made her do it, but he was just ready to turn her and hit her back, and she kind of stepped back, get out of his way, and it happened so slowly. Her rear leg slipped off the edge of the cliff, and she kind of was hung up, half on and half off. I knew what was happening. I knew I couldn't help him. And the guy was frantic. He was trying to pull her back out, and then all of a sudden, you know, whoosh, and with her mooing head, she disappeared and went off the cliff, and it was horrible.
And apparently a kind of accident that happens quite frequently on those cliffs in Wales.
It was, you know, and I was surprised at that. I got out of there immediately. I thought the farmer might get mad at me. I didn't have anything to do with it. But the next village, I stopped, and I had some coffee, and I told him about that. No, I said, no big deal. No big deal. It happens all the time. And I said, what? He says, yeah. Maybe once a year, a cow falls off a cliff.
And apparently, if you're a sailor in those parts, you have to watch out.
One of the fellas at this little pub was a sailor, as a matter of fact, and he was telling me about a friend of his that hit a cow, floating cow, and caved in the front of his boat. He was very upset about it.
So you learned some pretty extraordinary things.
Don't trust cows, for one thing.
But I think that story really drives home the point of how not only were you a long way from home in traveling, but because of the kind of journey that you took, you separated yourself from everything you knew.
Yeah, I did. I was by myself, and, you know, I meet friends easily, and I was separated from, the States for a while, but I've got so comfortable over there. It really doesn't seem like a big separation. I would love to go back if there are any other countries, but I think I've walked across most of them.
So was that part of the allure or even the adrenaline of doing this, to be so separate from the world you knew?
I knew once I got over there that it was, you know, I just couldn't turn around and come back. So I knew that I was committed the minute I got on the plane. And then the minute I got on the boots and left the last bed and breakfast, you know, before the trip, I knew that I wasn't going to stop until I finished. And I was just lucky. I had a wonderful experiences other than that silly accident in the bathtub. You know, I never slipped and fell ever and hurt myself. And I, you know, kind of providence, I think. God was looking out for me, that's for sure.
So is there a next adventure on the horizon?
You know, I still go over to Great Britain. I go over metal detecting now. And I join groups over there, and we do a lot of walking of fields, not long-distance walkings, but it's plenty of exercise, and I really enjoy that. It's always been a hobby of mine. So I continue to do that whenever I can, maybe every other year. As long as I can, I'll do that.
And you haven't talked your wife into going with you yet, or have you?
My wife is, you know, she's the walker in the family, actually. She gets a big kick out of this, she says, because, you know, I won't walk across the street with her here in the States, but I'll walk across a country. She just thinks it's crazy, but she lets me do it.
Well, Robert, thank you so much for sharing your adventures with us today.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
Robert Buckley lives in Marion, Iowa, and he has written about his adventures on five incredible long-distance walks in the book 2 Miles an Hour. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese. Lindsay Moon and Emily Woodbury. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. You can send us email anytime. Send us suggestions for things you'd like to hear on the show, reactions to things you've heard on the show. Talk of Iowa at iowapublicradio.org. Our theme music was composed and performed by the River Monks. Tomorrow on the show, we'll talk about teaching healthy relationship skills to women behind bars. I'm Charity Nebbe. Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio News.